I'm Dan Rodericks, and this is Midday. Amy Chua's Tiger Mom memoir about strict parenting brought her lots of attention, and her new book takes on another controversial subject, why certain ethnic, religious, and immigrant groups are doing strikingly better than Americans overall. Amy Chua joins us for the second hour of Midday to talk about what drives success, why certain groups are more apt to succeed in life than others. Up front, we return to the intersection of money and politics. First, Citizens United, then the McCutcheon case, how Supreme Court rulings that smash limitations on campaign contributions could affect national and state elections, including the one this year for governor of Maryland. Midday starts after the news from NPR. Welcome to Midday, everyone. Dan Rodericks here again on WYPR Baltimore, WYPF Frederick and Hagerstown, WYPO Ocean City and the Eastern Shore, and streaming live online through WYPR.org. We thank you again for making Midday part of your day. In this hour of the show, Money and Politics, a look at the effect of Supreme Court decisions on national and state elections, including Maryland's. This is a follow-up to the conversation we had on Friday. Just 10 days ago, the Maryland election officials said that they will no longer enforce a state law that imposes an overall limit of $10,000 on campaign contributions to Maryland candidates in a four-year election cycle. The Supreme Court decision, known as McCutcheon, which was about federal limits, essentially voided the Maryland law. The court ruled that the aggregate contribution limits are invalid under the First Amendment. Therefore, Maryland's law, which limits such contributions to $10,000, as I said, cannot be enforced. However, state officials said they would continue to enforce a Maryland law limiting individuals to contributing no more than $4,000 to any particular candidate during an election cycle. But donors are now free to give $4,000, up to $4,000, to as many candidates as they wish. Before the McCutcheon ruling, of course, the conservative Supreme Court had already started to liberalize the nation's campaign finance laws. It ruled famously in 2010 in the Citizens United case that campaign contributions by corporations, associations, or unions amounted to a form of speech and could not be prohibited. With all of these shifting laws relating to donations to politicians, the current Maryland governor's campaign underway, and the forthcoming midterm elections here in 2014, we thought we'd spend some time taking a look at campaign finance laws in Maryland and across the country. A little later in the show, we'll be joined by attorney Bruce Marcus. He chaired a bipartisan state commission that looked at Maryland's campaign finance laws and issued a report to the General Assembly. The report made recommendations as to so the state could better manage the influence of money in Maryland's political races. We'll also be joined by Emily Scar, Executive Director of Maryland's the Maryland Public Interest Research Group, or Mary Perg, the watchdog group, currently is in support of a bill sponsored by Maryland Representative John Sarbanes that would increase the influence of small donations, small donors. So we'll talk about that in a little bit later on during this hour of the show. We start off, however, with Andy Kroll. Lucky to have Andrew Kroll with us. He follows so-called dark money from Mother Jones. Dark money is the term used to describe anonymous and suspicious donations made to candidates allegedly used to ensure that a politician will favor the interests of their donors. Andy Kroll will give us the nationwide picture of how American political races have changed post-Citizens United and now post-McCutcheon. So Andy Kroll from Mother Jones, nice to have you on the show with us. Thanks for joining us.
It's my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Andy, let's go to the McCutcheon ruling and just give a little bit more exposition on what happened there. I mentioned what's going to happen in Maryland as a consequence of that, but would you please just talk about the ruling itself in terms of federal elections? What limits were in place, and what limits did the court say are unconstitutional?
I can give you the backstory, and that will, I think, is the best way to explain what was at stake in this McCutcheon decision and how that's changed. So there was a fellow out of Alabama named Sean McCutcheon, a wealthy businessman, and during the 2012 election season, Mr. McCutcheon wanted to contribute to several dozen candidates that he supported. He's a conservative fellow. He wanted to cut checks in the amount of $1,776, $1,776, to an array of candidates that he liked. And what he found was that there is a ceiling on the number of donations that one person can give to a number of candidates. And we're not talking about the actual amount of money that me, a donor, could give to you, a candidate. I'm talking about how many of those different donations I can give out during one election season. What is the number of donations, not the amount? And Mr. McCutcheon found that there was a limit. He wanted to give to, 28 or 29 candidates, and they were going to stop him at 27. And he, in his wisdom, thought that this was a bad idea and sued. He was eventually joined by the Republican National Committee, the National Republican Party, in effect. And this case went all the way to the Supreme Court. And the Supreme Court this year ruled in his favor, the five conservative justices at least, and said that we don't believe that there is any constitutional reason to limit the number of donations. Again, that ceiling on how many donations you can make as a donor, not the actual amount, the limit on the amount. And so they struck that down. And so now an individual donor could essentially support as many candidates as are on the ballot at the federal level, as are running for the House, as are running for the United States Senate, and giving, $2,600 checks to hundreds of people, whereas before they were limited to, fewer than 20.
Mm-hmm.
So this is what we have now with this limit struck down is donors can spread their money far and wide across the country in as many races as there are in play in that particular year.
So the amount, the limitation on the amount is still in place, the court said. But it's the number. A wealthy donor can give as many checks as they wish.
That's exactly right. So if I wanted to support a candidate running for Congress right now, and it's the primary season, my limit is $2,600. For a federal race,
mm-hmm.
I cannot give $2,601. That is that basic donor to candidate limit. That is intact. And the four of the conservative justices on the Supreme Court said that that's fine. We're going to leave that intact. Justice Clarence Thomas actually went further in his own sort of separate opinion and said, I think we should strike that down too. But so far, he is alone in that. But now, post McCutcheon, me, the donor, I can write that $2,600 check for hundreds of people. If you wanted, this wouldn't really make sense, but if you wanted, for every House candidate running for office every 2 years, as they do, and for every single Senate candidate out there, if I really felt like it. So the money can go much, farther around the country now. You can as a donor play in many more races than you could before this decision.
Here's a quote from the dissent in the McCutcheon ruling. Taken together with Citizens United versus Federal Elections Commission, today's decision eviscerates our nation's campaign finance laws, leaving a remnant incapable of dealing with the grave problems of democratic legitimacy that those laws were intended to resolve. Someone listening to this may wonder, why was this limit put in place to begin with? It seems like intuitive. It seems like something we should all understand, that there need to be limitations on the amount one individual can give to a particular candidate. So that stays in place. But in terms of the number of donations you can make nationwide, if you want to influence an election, a congressional district election in another state, why shouldn't you be allowed to do that? And Andy, I just wonder if you could characterize the rationale for such a limitation.
The rationale going back to the creation of these laws, which these are post-Watergate regulations enacted by a reform-minded Congress in the wake of the Watergate scandal, which, let's remember, was a campaign finance scandal at its core.
Mm-hmm.
The rationale for this particular limit we're talking about in McCutcheon was a fear of what the court called, basically circumventing the basic limits between you and I, and in a sense saying donors can find a way to, even if they can't exceed the limit, today, $2,600 from me to you, that there are ways to pool your money and to funnel that money into whether it's particular races or it's the Democratic or Republican Party or it's all the assorted committees and political action committees that are around today. The court, in upholding this limit in the 1970s in the case called Buckley versus Vallejo, said that there was a risk of circumvention, that donors would find a way to funnel huge sums of money into parties and into political committees and would be able to unduly influence and create the appearance of corruption or corruption without this overall limit. And so the court upheld this overall limit in that case and said that it is important. It is a check against the appearance of corruption or corruption between donors and candidates and donors and parties, and that it's important. And that limit stayed in place until this McCutcheon decision. And you know, from the dissent that you read and from the filings and the arguments made by opponents of the McCutcheon decision, they argued very much the same thing, that if you don't have this overall limit, there are ways for donors to funnel several million dollars in essentially one check into candidates and parties and party committees and political action committees. There's even a new term of art that's going around now called max committees or super joint fundraising committees, essentially the new vehicle for taking these big checks in the wake of the McCutcheon decision. So there's a very strong argument on the opposing side saying without this, again, this sort of overall limit or aggregate limit, donors can now cut checks of six figures or seven figures that go to the party and exert the kind of influence that the law was intended to stop. Now, Chief Justice John Roberts didn't buy those scenarios, didn't buy those hypotheticals, in his opinion, which is why, you know, he partly ruled in favor of McCutcheon.
What's to keep them from moving on, as Clarence Thomas has suggested, in overturning Buckley versus Vallejo? I mean, once you accept the premise that money is a form of expression, what's to keep them from doing away even with that limitation?
I don't think there is something to keep them from doing away with that limitation. I don't think that Justice Thomas has much work to do convincing his conservative colleagues that even the most basic limit on money in politics, how much I, the donor, can give you, the candidate, I don't think that Justice Thomas has much work to do to convince them that that's unconstitutional and that if a Republican donor wants to give a candidate $1 million, that they should be able to do that. That is the direction the Roberts Court is going. And I believe that since John Roberts became the Chief Justice, you have seen one case after another of the high court chipping away at those post-Watergate regulations. And the McCutcheon opinion left the door open, both with Justice Thomas's opinion and some of the language in Chief Justice Roberts's, to knocking down that last pillar of campaign finance. I mean, in my mind, you know, in looking at history in this area, I mean, the only thing that could possibly change their mind was actually seeing, you know, some real evidence of corruption happen in this, you know, increasingly deregulated world, and the one that we seem to be heading toward. But maybe that won't change their mind.
Andy, in what way does McCutcheon broaden the definition of dark money, which you follow for closely from Mother Jones?
Well, I think the McCutcheon decision has the potential to bring a lot more money into the system. I think we will still have a pretty good idea of where that money is coming from, who is writing the check, and to whom it's going. On the matter of dark money, I don't know if there's a huge impact here from the McCutcheon decision. You know, it was really the Citizens United decision in 2010 and some subsequent rulings that threw open the doors in terms of what we call dark money, anonymous money going through nonprofit organizations that say they're for the, quote, social welfare, but really seem to be about influencing politics and getting people elected. McCutcheon still has some amount of transparency involved. I guess there's a silver lining, maybe, in that. But, you know, the dark money universe is kind of its own thing apart from McCutcheon, but is very much increasing, just as the money through McCutcheon will be increasing as well.
Let's reserve a little time in this hour to talk some more about that. Thanks again for joining us. Andy Kroll will be with us for the hour from Mother Jones. When we get back, we'll take a closer look at the picture here in Maryland with attorney Bruce Marcus, who chaired a state commission that examined the state's campaign finance laws. And Emily Scar joins us, executive director of the Maryland Public Interest Research Group at Mary Perg. If you'd like to join us, please give us a call, 410-662-8780. Our toll-free long-distance number, 866-661-9309. And the Midday email address. You can write a question or comment that way, midday@wypr.org. Dan Rodrick's here. A short break. We'll be right back. And welcome back to Midday. Dan Rodrick's here, taking a look at money and politics in this hour. Andy Kroll joining us from Mother Jones. In a moment, we'll speak with Bruce Marcus and Emily Scar. Andy, while I have you here, and on the subject of the McCutcheon ruling, a quick comment or question from Jim in Anne Arundel County. Jim, go right ahead. Welcome to Midday.
Hi. I invented a system called political sheepdog. It's a market approach to good government.
Okay, hold on a minute. Do you have a question or comment about McCutcheon?
What?
Never mind. We'll go to George in Annapolis. George, we'll take your question or comment. Go right ahead, please.
Thank you. Say, I'd like to hear some comments on not just individuals, but on the on corporations and unions being able to make donations. And actually, I think if unions are allowed to, which they had been, then corporations should too. But I don't think either one of them should be allowed to. And if we just had an individual limit, only individuals could contribute, and they could only contribute to people that they have a right to vote for. It seems like then that we would have a much cleaner and logical system.
Okay. Well, you got to take that argument back to the Supreme Court, George, because that's essentially Citizens United. Andy, you can comment on that, but let me introduce Bruce Marcus, who chaired the state commission that examined Maryland's campaign finance laws in the wake of the Citizens United ruling and some other issues that were before the legislature. Hello, Bruce. Nice to have you with us.
Good afternoon, Dan. Good
and
to be with you.
Emily Scar is with us as well, executive director of the Maryland Public Interest Research Group, Mary Perg. Nice to have you with us too, Emily.
Thank you.
Did you want to respond to our caller's comment there about unions and corporations?
Interesting observation because, Dan, your point is spot on. The case of Citizens United addressed squarely the ability of corporations and unions and other organizations to participate in federal elections. Maryland did not have a similar prohibition for corporations to participate in the process. And obviously in the Citizens United case, the issue related to a film that had been put together ostensibly as a campaign piece to oppose then-Senator Clinton in her bid to become president. And what happened was whether or not the use of organization money was permitted, a suit was filed in order to allow that film to be distributed. And ultimately, the Supreme Court used that and the First Amendment analysis to say that corporations, like citizens, are taxed.
Mm-hmm.
They have obligations, and if they are treated as individuals for all purposes under the law, criminal liability and the like, that they too enjoy First Amendment privilege. And to the extent that there's any kind of abridgment or restriction that would be imposed on a corporation or organization, that may well implicate First Amendment questions. And it was on that basis that Citizens United was handed down, and that really was the beginning of independent expenditures and things of that nature.
Well, you know, some people were pleased with this decision. A lot of people were not. Several states have tried to take some action to, I guess, what? I don't know, Emily. You can't really go against the Supreme Court once the Supreme Court has ruled there, but I guess we have seen some efforts in some states to, what, compress maybe the consequences of the Citizens United case?
Well, I think on two fronts.
I'm not finding the right word for that.
Well, the silver lining in all of this is that the terrible decisions by the Supreme Court have awakened state governments and American public about the need to fix our campaign finance system. So already 16 states and over 500 cities and towns have come out publicly against Citizens United, pressuring Congress to move forward on a constitutional amendment. And then states are also moving forward with more aggressive public financing and small donor incentive programs to try to mitigate the bad situation we have here to restore more political equality for Americans.
And Bruce, your commission spotted a loophole in the law. It's sort of relevant to this. I think it'd be good for you to just go over that briefly for our listeners. The loophole you found with regard to limited liability corporations in Maryland, and what was going on, and what loophole was closed?
The issue that came up was the treatment of certain kinds of business organizations. We know that the law allows people to form corporations, people can form partnerships, and they have the ability to form another variety of business organization, which is called a limited liability company. And when the limited liability company legislation, with the first laws that allowed that to happen in Maryland, were first passed, there was apparently an omission in the way that limited liability companies were to be perceived. Under the law, if I owned the stock in three corporations, the way that the law would work is I can't use each of those corporations, if they're 100% owned by me, to give three times the amount, because under that scenario, the fact that I've just simply divided my corporations up would allow me to give three times whatever the limits were. So for limited liability companies, they were not construed to have that same kind of restriction. The so-called loophole, and I'm not sure it was a loophole as much as it was just a drafting error, allowed people with multiple limited liability companies to have multiple limits, to give more money for every limited liability company that they had. And our commission took the position that it was unfair for people who opted to use limited liability companies as a way, willingly or not, to sort of have additional room to make campaign contributions.
So, you closed that. So the change in the law leaves it as what then? One donation?
If you are a company and you have subsidiaries that are wholly owned, or if you're a company and you're controlled by the same group, then for purposes of determining how much you can give, it's going to be one limit. And that way, everybody is treated fairly.
Andy Crow, I want to ask you sort of for the bigger picture, the broad picture of Citizens United's influence, say, in 2012 and what we're seeing this year. Are we seeing corporations give more money through PACs? Is more of that money coming down the pike? I know that the 2012 presidential election was the most expensive in history, but the 2016 will probably be the most expensive in history. This will probably just continue. But as far as Citizens United's influence on this whole process, what are we seeing? What's the big picture of that?
Well, the Citizens United decision was handed down, and it was met by outrage and real concerns that this decision had opened a floodgate, it's a phrase you heard a lot, to corporate money, corporate treasuries directly from corporations, into running ads and independent ads and campaigns, funneling money into the political system, ostensibly independent of candidates that are running, but that we were just going to see ads paid for by X corporation or Y corporation. Those worst case scenarios didn't really come true. What we saw were a few corporations dip their toe in, and in some cases that those activities blew back on them. I mean, a famous case was Target Corporation in Minnesota, had given some money to a political committee that had been doing some of its own work against the issue of marriage equality. That blew up in Target's face. There were boycotts. There were walkouts of stores. There was all kinds of issues, and it was a horrible PR debacle for Target. And I think the Target situation really rattled a lot of people in corporate America. And so you didn't see Fortune 500 companies absolutely deluging the political process with money. Now, what we have seen, obviously, is the rise of so-called super PACs. A follow-up decision in 2010 gave us super PACs, which can raise and spend unlimited amounts of money. They cannot technically coordinate with a campaign, but what we often see are candidate-specific super PACs. It's run by a friend, it's run by a former staffer, it's run by someone with some kind of relationship to the candidate in question. And you've seen a lot of very wealthy folks pumping huge amounts of money into super PACs and using, you know, super PACs to prop up a candidate, using super PACs to defeat opponents of a candidate that you prefer. Super PACs were effective for President Obama. The super PAC that backed Mitt Romney was the biggest spending of all. And so those were big players. And what we've also seen a little bit of is corporate money going into, again, this dark money route, going into nonprofit organizations that are, you know, flirting with how much money they can spend on politics, you know, towing that line about how much political spending is too much. There's an organization, Crossroads GPS, started and backed in part by Karl Rove, that has been a huge player here. And we've gotten a glimpse a few occasions of some of these big spending nonprofit groups and have seen some corporate money going in there. And so it seems like, as best that we can tell, corporations have avoided using super PACs to a large degree because they do disclose their donors and perhaps have instead chosen the anonymous route, which allows them to get their money and exert some influence on elections and on policy as well, and do it without their name being out there.
Let's go to Emily Scar from Mary Perg on this.
Yeah, I just wanted to, Marilyn Perg's done quite a bit of research on this, and while the situation might not have been as bad as it could be, the first presidential election after Citizens United was pretty terrible. We actually saw an almost 400% increase in outside spending from mega donors, businesses, and dark money nonprofits that hide their, who's contributing through shell corporations. In fact, it only took 32 billionaires and corporations to match every single dollar that was given to the Romney and Obama campaigns combined. Those mega donors gave an average of $9.9 million apiece to super PACs, matching the $313 million that came from more than 3.7 million Americans. So certainly it could get even worse, and I'm worried it will. With McCutcheon, we've done research that shows that $1 billion more will be added to direct campaign contributions through 2020. From less than 3,000 people. So while it could, again, get much worse, we're already seeing dramatic effects. And I think the 2014 elections in Maryland are going to see a serious increase in outside spending on state races from governor all the way down to county council.
Bruce Marcus, when you sat on this commission post Citizens United, there must have been members of this 17-member commission who said, there's nothing we can do. The Supreme Court has ruled that corporations are people. A company is a person and can give a donation, or money is a form of expression under the Constitution. There's nothing we can do. We can't close this without a constitutional amendment. Was this expressed on the commission?
And in fact, Maryland has permitted corporations to participate by making campaign contributions. That was not a prohibition in Maryland. The Citizens United case struck down the federal prohibition.
Right.
And so because our General Assembly, our legislature in Maryland, can only enact laws that govern state elections, the commission was concerned about this influx of supposedly independent expenditures. And as Emily,
independent expenditures,
and that is a term of art. It means that there's not supposed to be any coordination. It means that the people involved in spending decisions and purchasing of airtime or whatever the media is have to do so without conferring or aligning themselves with the campaign. Mm-hmm. And our commission was concerned about making sure that it was clear where the money was coming from and how those contributions are to be reported. So the fallout of Citizens United was less of an impact on Maryland's elections and more on the idea of having Maryland sort of go to the fore of regulations on independent expenditures to shine a light on who the contributors are. Then voters and people who are interested in elections have an idea to see who's behind it.
Well, speaking of that, and I'll ask Andy about this and Emily about this, the idea that with the McCutcheon case, okay, so we're going to have very wealthy people writing numerous checks, to, you know, congressional campaigns all over the country, theoretically. You know, I need $2,000 for this guy over here, $4,000 for this woman over here. And it doesn't matter where you live, you can make these donations, right? So it's been suggested that in light of that, instant transparency is what we need. We need to know where the donations are coming from as quickly as possible, because electronically these days, reporting can be much faster than it has been, than it is currently. So what about that as a possible balance to the doors that the Supreme Court just opened with McCutcheon? Andy, I'll go to you on that first.
As much transparency as can be implemented in the system is fantastic. And the McCutcheon decision, as Emily said, you know, has the potential to just throw more money into the system. There is a level of disclosure with that kind of spending. We have to wait to see how this is going to work, because we're not even quite sure how McCutcheon is going to play out entirely. But there is some transparency there. Could it be increased? Could it be more rigorous? Absolutely. However, and I should add also, the Supreme Court has said, both in the Citizens United decision and in McCutcheon, that transparency is important. And in fact, they have tried to tamp down the concerns of the minority and of their critics by saying, well, you know, all of the spending is not a big deal if there's transparency and the people know where the money is coming from. I don't think that has quite been borne out in the wake of Citizens United, as I explained earlier. Mm-hmm. However, what I would add is, now that the campaign finance regulations about how much someone can give and how much a corporation can spend, this part of the equation, now that these rules are falling, thanks to a decades-long effort by, you know, some of the sharpest conservative and libertarian lawyers out there, I know I've interviewed them, now that they're close to winning that fight, we are now seeing them back away from the values of disclosure and transparency. We are now seeing them say, well, you know, transparency is really just a code word for retaliation, or for drawing up enemies lists, or, you know, using it against the people who are engaging in this speech. And so now, you know, the idea of transparency and disclosure in campaign spending is under attack, and it has been. And so while it's a great idea, there is far from universal agreement that is what should be done in the wake of these decisions.
Boy. Emily.
Sure. And I absolutely agree that more transparency certainly helps mitigate the negative effects of these decisions. But I think there are actually more aggressive and better solutions we could do to fix our campaign finance system. So if you think about it, the big money in politics, what it does is limits who can run for office, who wins elections, and ultimately our public policy.
Right.
So by actually supporting measures to create more public financing and small donor incentives, we can expand that pool back to more people to be able to run for office and encourage more people to actually make contributions, average Americans to make contributions.
This sounds like a great preparation for talking about the Government by the People Act, sponsored by Representative John Sarbanes of Maryland.
Well, absolutely. The good news about small donor incentives is they're happening at all levels of government. So, yes, absolutely. The National Government by the People Act would set this up for at the federal level. Congressman Sarbanes, the Montgomery County Council here in Maryland is also poised to pass their own and first in the nation public financing here in Maryland.
Well, we're going to take a break. When we get back, you can talk about that, explain the elements of the Government by the People Act. Emily Scar from Maryland Public Interest Research Group. Attorney Bruce Marcus, who served as chairman of a bipartisan commission that looked at Maryland's campaign finance laws and made recommendations to the General Assembly. And Andy Kroll from Mother Jones. We're talking about money in politics, the Supreme Court rulings with regard to campaign donations. We'll take a short break here and come back. You can join our conversation at 410-662-8780. And you know, we talked about this a little bit on Friday's show. We spent some time discussing McCutcheon with Jennifer Bevendangle of Common Cause Maryland, and Bruce Robinson, who was a member of your commission, Bruce Marcus, this bipartisan 17-member state commission that looked at the campaign finance rulings. And I just thought our listeners and our guests today would be interested in hearing some of the thoughts shared by these two guests. I asked Jennifer about the McCutcheon ruling, and here's what she had to say.
We're very concerned about this decision. At the federal level, it'll certainly open doors to some very large donors having an undue influence in the process. But as you can see, we're already seeing very immediate effects in Maryland with the State Board of Elections saying we have to get rid of our caps, too. I think the impact in Maryland will be far worse than what we'll see even at the national level.
Now, Bruce Robinson had a very different take on this. I mean, he's in favor of eliminating caps on campaign contributions generally. This is what he had to say about McCutcheon.
Those people who wish to, who have those resources and would like to contribute them, should be given the opportunity to have their speech heard. We're cutting them off because they have money, and that seems like a very unconstitutional thing to do to them just because they have the money to make that contribution. People without money have many, many other ways of contributing to campaigns, whether they knock on doors, put signs up, lick envelopes, do mailings, talk to their friends, have barbecues in their backyard to help their candidate. That's what's within their means, whereas the head of a multi-corporate conglomerate organization spends their time making their money, and they can contribute cash.
We received several calls and emails about Bruce's comments there, you know, saying basically the little people who don't have money can have bake sales or barbecues and lick envelopes, whereas the people with money, they have money, so don't hold it against them that they have money and can write checks, multiple checks, $4,000, you know, $24,000 checks, $54,000 checks. Don't hold it against them because they're wealthy.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's absolutely the conversation we need to be having as a public right now is, do we want a campaign finance system where your voice is measured by the depth of your pockets, or one where every citizen, regardless of wealth or geography, has a more or less equal opportunity to influence elections and the public policy that follows?
Emily Scar from Maryland Public Interest Research Group. Now, please describe what this act is, the proposed act. Sponsored by Representative John Sarbanes of Maryland, the Government by the People Act. This is to get more, smaller voices, smaller donors involved in this process?
Yeah, to counter the influence of big money in politics, John Sarbanes' Government by the People Act would enable more Americans to support the candidates they believe in with a tax credit for small contributions.
A tax credit?
Yeah.
So tell me how that works. I make a $25, $50 donation. What happens?
Exactly. The first $25 people contribute would be qualify for what they're calling a My Voice tax credit that they would get back on their tax returns. In addition, the contributions under $150 would be matched at a 6-to-1 basis.
Okay, let's stop there. So I give candidate Joe Schmo, say, $100, right? That's a pretty small donation. I get a $25 tax credit against that?
Yep.
Okay. And a donation, what'd you say, under 150?
Exactly.
Gets matched by?
6-to-1.
6-to-1 for the candidate?
Yep.
Candidate Joe Schmo gets six times that?
Yeah.
From where? What source is that coming from?
Public funding through the government.
Public funding. Okay. Yeah. All right. People haven't gone for public funding very much here. Didn't we have a checkoff in Maryland once upon a time on our taxes?
We in fact did, and we have a vestige of public finance in the gubernatorial race prior to this upcoming election. I think Mrs. Sarabray was probably the only person who made use of that.
I remember that.
And there was a substantial amount of money that has essentially been held in suspense since the 1994 election. Obviously, campaign finance that is predicated on public sources has a whole variety of administrative problems that are associated with it, because there has to be, number one, some new organization, governmental organizational structure to oversee it. And mm-hmm. then secondly, as Emily points out, you got to have a funding source.
Emily, this legislation you're talking about would be federal. This would be for federal elections.
Yes.
Okay. Andy, what do you think about this? Andy Kroll's with us from Mother Jones. This bill, I noticed, has quite a few sponsors already.
Yeah, it's garnered bipartisan support, and it's an idea that has been kicking around for several years now. I tend to think it's one of the more logical responses in the post-Citizens United era, frankly, in the era of the John Roberts Court. I mean, more limits, more regulations stand little chance with the Roberts Court the way it is now, and so reformers have looked around and tried to find some kind of solution that would pass constitutional muster, and that also gets at this idea of getting more people involved. You know, a phrase you hear a lot is lifting people up, as opposed to setting limits at some certain level for donations and campaign finance. You have seen this matching system that Emily describes used, for instance, in New York City in the elections there, and current Mayor Bill de Blasio used this system quite effectively to win the Democratic primary, and obviously that means that he becomes the mayor. The idea makes a lot of sense, and the notion of getting more people involved is a noble one. And in terms of, you know, people always ask, well, you say public financing, you say, you know, this money is coming from some place within the government. It's not as if the federal government is short on waste and overspending in different projects and different agencies in you know, the military, for instance, being a great example. So it's pretty clear that there are places to cut and there are places to reallocate funds if you're really interested in getting people to participate in the political process by donating and also by interacting and feeling more invested in their political office holders than they currently are now.
I mean, could it be that congressmen, representatives in Congress, men and women are happy with this idea because they spend so much time raising money the conventional way through big donors, bigger donors, lobbyists and whatnot?
I certainly hope so. I mean, the amount of time that people have to spend raising money to win elections is terrifying. You know, as my grandfather likes to say, we have the best government that money can buy. And I think going to a public financing system is well worth it to get big money out of politics and actually just restore the basic nature of our democracy, where elections are about ideas, not about who can raise the most money.
The whole idea here, Government by the People Act, is to get more people involved in this process, smaller donors, and the reward for getting smaller donors is matching funds, public matching funds for candidates.
Yeah, and it encourages candidates to be actually going to get money from more people as opposed to single large contributors. I mean, whoever raises the most money right now wins the elections 9 times more than the candidate who raises less money. That's not the way it necessarily should be.
Bruce Marcus?
The interesting part about the whole debate in public finances, we actually in our commission did an investigation into other public finance campaign schemes and regimes, and we actually looked long and hard at the New York model. Not this last time, obviously, because the commission was in 2012 and the beginning of the year in 2011, or the end of the year in 2011. And what we found was that the amount of money that was given out in New York in 2009 was $27 million to 139 candidates in New York. But the cost of administering the public finance campaign structure in New York approached $40 to $50 million. And so when you take a look at these numbers...
Something wrong there.
Well, the numbers, this was a program in its infancy.
Yeah.
And of course, one of the interesting things that came out of the New York model was our commission posed a question to one of the witnesses and said, well, how did it work in the mayoral election, and not this past election, but how did it work for publicly financed candidates running against Mr. Bloomberg? How did they fare? And of course, the answer was... you know, sort of rhetorical. People who have money will still be able to run. They don't necessarily have to participate in public finance. Arizona is probably the most successful state in public finance programs. We in Maryland now have the ability to have public finance in some of our elections. And in fact, our commission made a recommendation in the General Assembly of Maryland, passed law that allows the counties in Maryland to conduct publicly financed elections, to develop their own scheme and regime for overseeing publicly financed elections.
Is that law now?
It is the law. But what they have to do is they have to generate money and B, a structure to organize it.
Let's take a couple of calls here in the remaining minutes of this show. Hilda and Frederick, go right ahead. Welcome to the show.
Yes, sir. I'd like to make a suggestion.
I
got my fifth letter this month for a donation to help Bare Feet have shoes on them. I think for every dollar that anybody gives to a political campaign, they should be asked to give a dollar to some charitable organization.
Okay. We'll take that one under advisement. Thank you, Hilda. I like the idea. You know, I'll pass that along to Representative Sarbanes as well. I think he just wants to get this law passed first. Mike in Annapolis, go right ahead. Hi.
Hi. Yeah, this question was for the Maryland Public Interest Group. Emily, are there any other specific ideas to address money in politics other than this idea you described here? Because anything that encourages, you know, more transparency specifically.
Yeah, I mean, I think there are a couple things. Federally, we could stop dark money from going into shell corporations by actually requiring corporations to disclose who runs them. And then locally, you could also give people more control over corporate spending. So by enabling state and large corporations to, enabling shareholders to actually control what contributions are being made by the corporations that they are involved in, could both promote transparency and more accountability for corporations.
We'll go to Harford County for our next caller. Sean, welcome to Midday.
Hi. So my quick question is, what under the McCutcheon ruling prevents the creation of pass-through candidates, candidates that would run specifically to get on the ballot, gather these types of uncontrolled donations, and then later, say after a primary, funnel them back through to a pre-selected candidate or group or party?
Interesting scenario I hadn't thought of, because a candidate can give his or her money to someone else, can't they? Bruce, do you want to say something about it?
We, in Maryland, we have limits on inter-committee transfers. Uh-huh. So the use of money, at least at the state level, is limited so that one campaign finance unit or a candidate's committee, in most instances, cannot just make unlimited amounts of contributions from one committee to the other.
I didn't know that. If my committee raises $100,000 for, say, a state Senate seat, and then I decide not to run, what can I do with that $100,000?
That raises a different issue. The one thing that you can do is you can contribute under the current law $6,000, make a transfer to another person's committee. The law does provide for what would happen if you no longer are a candidate for office, and you are basically finished in elected office. You would then be able to use that money for very limited purposes, most of which relate to contributions to public higher institutions of higher education.
Is that right? What about on the federal level, Andy? Do you want to address that?
We're still seeing how this McCutcheon decision is going to play out. I mean, we on the Republican side, we've already seen the creation of sort of this new breed of sort of super fundraising committee, a committee that could, you know, be one sort of receiving point for these big checks to then distribute them to candidates and committees and PACs and so forth. But in terms of all the different ways to game the system, I'm really, you know, reporting on and waiting to see how this
frontier.
It is completely new frontier. And the thing that we've seen in the past is that there are armies of incredibly smart lawyers, mostly here in Washington, D.C., whose job it is to figure out where the loopholes are and where the weak points are and how to get as much money in as possible. And so if there's a way, I'm sure someone here will figure it out.
And it's Andy Kroll's job to keep an eye on those guys and report on them and Mother Jones. Thank you for being with us today, Andy. It was great to have you.
Thank you.
Yep, Andrew Kroll, who writes for Mother Jones and follows specifically our dark money for Mother Jones, motherjones.com. Emily Scar is the executive director of Maryland Public Interest Research Group, Maryland PIRG, P-I-R-G. And we got to get some more information out there to our listeners about the Government by the People Act. Maybe we should get John Sarbanes on the show to talk about this. A couple years ago, he was on the show talking about how he wanted to finance his campaign, get more small donors involved, and I guess it's evolved into this thing, so it's great. Emily, thanks for being here.
Thank you for having
me. Yeah, please come back and visit. And Bruce Marcus, a pleasure to have you on the show. Attorney Bruce Marcus, who's based in Montgomery County, served as the chairman of the state commission, a bipartisan commission on Maryland's campaign finance laws that made recommendations to the General Assembly a couple of years ago. Bruce, thank you very much.
pleasure being with you. Thank you.
Thank you, everyone, for joining us for the first hour of Midday. Please stick around for the second hour. Coming up, our conversation with Amy Chua. Right now, we'll take a break for lunch, brought to us by The Veranda, located in Hamden on 36th Street, serving home-style Indian food, specializing in flatbreads and chaat. The Veranda now opens 7 days a week for lunch, 11:30 to 4 p.m. Thanks to The Veranda for providing lunch for our guests. See you for the second hour after the news.